Okay, so we are coming up on the end of Daniel, so let me pray real quick, and then we'll do some housekeeping things. Dear Heavenly Father, I just thank you for the time again tonight to be together. Lord, just again anoint this class with what you want us to hear as we prepare the difficult 11th chapter. It's tough to get all that historical background and sort it all out. So, Lord, just help us have clear minds and ears to hear and eyes to see. We ask it all in Jesus' precious name. Amen. Okay, so in Daniel, there's a term paper due next week, basically. Your choice. You know, email me kind of what you're going to do it on, so I kind of have an idea, so I'm not caught off guard with what you're doing.
Just, I thought it was due today.
Did you do it today? Oh, perfect. Okay. Is it due today? I mean, it might even be due today. I don't know. Is it? I'm so non-committal to the timing of everything because, for me, everybody's got a full-time job, everybody's working, so it's like, yeah. If it was on the date, then it's my fault for not looking. So, what'd you do it on?
Just the character of Daniel, like his character.
Oh, cool.
Excellent.
Can
we look at it?
Can we all read it? Can we critique it?
Can we show us a reference for that, Dom?
So. And then, so get that to me by next Thursday.
Do you want us to email it to you? Would it be better?
Yeah, just email it to me. Okay. That'd be great, yeah.
And then the book report?
Yeah, and then the book report, right? Okay. And that's real simple to do. Just, I think the easiest way to do the book report is pick out three positives and three negatives in the book. So, like, we have a book report, right? Is that?
I thought we just did the chapters. We have to do a book report two on it?
I think at the end there's a book report, yeah.
No.
I didn't bring the syllabus. Who's got a syllabus?
Okay,
I didn't bring one. I'm talking without looking. I should have brought my syllabus, darn it.
Book report due.
I know, I didn't bring it. It's in the car.
Book report due?
It's in the car.
But I thought the book report was the paragraph of everything.
It's a book report, right?
It says book report 4 to 5 pages out of the textbook and then a term paper.
Yeah, so it's simple, Lisa. Let me help you. Take your summaries.
Okay.
And use those. There, you had pros and cons even in your summaries. You had things you saw. So you're just basically, real simply put, it's a 4-page paper. And what you want to do is Walford did these things well times 3. Walford did these things not so well, and that's and then a personal application at the end. This is what I got out of the book.
I might just skip that and get an F.
No, don't do that. Don't be a knuckle dragging Christian. Do it. So that's the simplest way to do it. 3 positives and 3 negatives. Does that make sense? And I think we all have one of the negatives right off the top of our head. The fact that he questions himself in every chapter.
He presents it like it's a fact and then tears it apart.
Yeah, exactly. It drives me nuts. In fact, I'll now tell you what I did when I studied Walford the second time is I read all the chapters from the back to the front.
Yeah,
I went and read the ends, and then I went to the ends back to the beginning because otherwise I was going, I'm so tired of arguing with myself.
I have to keep going back. Wait.
Yeah, so I just started from the back of the chapter and said, okay, this is what he really thinks. And then I went back the other way.
I struggled.
So, but academically, it's a great book because he really hits. He's quoted by every scholar that writes about Daniel. They quote him. So, does that make sense? Okay, perfect. All right. And Britt, you get extra points for having it in tonight. It's an automatic A without me even reading. I'll just like, yeah, there we go. So, okay. So, that takes care of the housekeeping. Then next week is our final class. So, we should get pretty far into chapter 12 tonight. So, if everybody wants to bring things to eat next week, we could eat and do the rest of chapter 12 and kind of have fellowship on the last night. Because I'm going to do a little bit of the Olivet Discourse, and a little bit of Ezekiel 38-39 at the same time. So, and of course, that means you got to bring in Revelation. So. All right, the first chart that I gave you guys. And thanks for hanging in last week, because I know there's six Seleucid wars or civil wars between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, six of them. And so they were all, we went through them all, and I gave you, here's the proof in history. But here we have Daniel 11, 14 to 20. You have the king of the south, which is Ptolemy Epiphanes, and then you have Antiochus the Great. Of course, his daughter is Cleopatra, the first one. He's the king of the north. And the insurgents in that middle part would be a combination of, remember I told you the Roman fleet came, and Antiochus the Great went and wanted to get the Macedonians to help him. Then the Romans came in. Why'd the Romans come in? Because they didn't want anybody to disrupt the wheat and corn coming out of Egypt, so they got involved. So you got all these world empires going, and that's kind of what you've got. And then on the bottom, I gave you actually a summary now and a chart of all those wars and who was in the wars. Remember I talked about Bernice and all those kind of people? So that you can go back over your notes and you can just kind of like see, okay, now I have a picture of what all these people are doing. Okay? So that's how I keep it straight. I have to have a chart. It's very confusing. Okay. Now, before I get into the thing, I want to go ahead and go over parallels of chapter 2, 7, and 8 right now on the handout that I have for you. And that's a chart. So if you look at it, in chapter 11, you've got four kings will appear, Persia, in chapter 11, verse 2. And then in chapter 7, you have the third beast, the leopard. It had four heads. Daniel 8:24. Four heads, of course, are what? The four generals, okay? Then you skip on down. The mighty king, 11, verse 3. That's Alexander the Great. He will rule with great power, 11:3. The fourth kingdom will be divided, a divided kingdom. That's in chapter 2 of Daniel. It'll be broken up and parceled out to those four generals. Okay, and then, of course, way over in chapter 8, we have confirmation that it's the goat in the Greek kingdom. All right? The goat became very great. His large horn was broken off, and in its place, four prominent grew up, the four winds of heaven. Of course, we know that's the four generals. Then we have the kings of the south down in 11, 5 to 20. Remember, the kings of the south are the Ptolemies. The kings of the north are the Seleucids. Okay? Of course, that was the general Ptolemy and Seleucus, two of the generals. All right? And then you have in chapter 2, notice you have the feet and toes, legs of the fourth kingdom. Because that's the kingdom of the south. We'll go to the kingdom of the north to make an alliance, but will not retain her power, and the power will not last. That's in 11:5. They'll mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another. 2:4-5. And then the king of the north will make an alliance, and we'll talk about that tonight. But you have all these parallels. Then look at the second page as you go down. And we'll get to 11:17. Then we have the in red there, the contemptible person. We're going to start in verse 21 tonight. Antiochus.
Ignore this.
Yeah, ignore the one on the back. You're going to go to the
mistake.
Yeah. Yeah, you have a third page, so ignore the one on the back. You actually have a third page. The Xerox machine did it for me the wrong way, so just skip the one on the back. So again, then you have, what I like to have is the middle there. It says, it's the little horn. He will say unheard things in 11:36. We'll get there tonight. That's the little horn. And again, it's under the chapter 11 and chapter 8, so you can kind of read that. It's really a great chart. And so kind of keep that out as we go tonight. Okay? And then that last one on the back side takes us all the way to Revelation and the end of Daniel. And again, in chapter 11, you have he, the contemptible person, 11, verse 45. That's comparable to chapter 7, verse 26. His little horn power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever. And same thing in chapter 8. So it's tremendous. So that gives you all the comparisons of all the chapters. So by the time you look at that, you'll go, oh, it all makes sense now. All right, one more. The literary parallels of Alexander the Great, chapter 11 and 8. This is just comparing chapter 11 and 8, because chapter 11, if you've noticed, really is starting to explain everything we saw in chapter 8 to greater detail. We need chapter 11 to understand chapter 8 that we did 3 weeks ago. So you have 11:3, a mighty king. Well, that's equivalent to 8:21, goat with the large horn being Alexander. He will rule with great power, 11:3. The goat became very great, Alexander the Great. 11:3 to 21, he came from one of the four divisions, because everything under Alexander the Great has to include those four generals. Does that make sense? Okay. So then you have chapter 8, 8 and 9, and chapter 8, 21 to 23, he came from one of the four divisions of the Greek Empire. Those divisions, of course, came from the four generals. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god. That's 11:36. We'll get there tonight. That, of course, is Antiochus Epiphanes. And 8:11, he set himself up to be as great as the prince of the host. Okay? And the same thing in 11:36, and then all the way to 8:24, you can see what he's doing over there. And then you have the next sheet. Again, you're comparing 8 and 11. Make sure you keep them right. So 11 is the first column. 8's the second column. Talks about the daily sacrifice being taken away. And then he invades the south of the beautiful land. And then in chapter 8, we know that he grew in power to the south and to the east toward the beautiful land, both times equivalent. The beautiful land, of course, is Israel. And then 11:32 to 33, we'll read there tonight. We're going to talk about the godly people, the wise men, and then 8:24, he will destroy those. And then the abomination in 8:31 that sets up desolation, that's when he does the pig in the temple. So all these are equivalents going all the way across. And then, of course, the last ones we'll get to tonight. So that makes all this kind of make sense. So you with me? Mm-hmm. All right. Now we'll get to the meat. So I'm going to start in chapter 11, verse 21. The vile person comes to power. And after all those civil wars, we now have Antiochus Epiphanes, the son of Antiochus the third, because he's the fourth. Okay, and it says, and in his place shall rise a vile person to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. Well, basically, history tells us that he was not the person supposed to achieve the birthright. He took over by his being able to speak and intrigue, trickery and stuff. So Antiochus IV, he comes illegitimately, because it's strongly suggested that he murdered his older brother, the previous king. The other potential heir, the son of Seleucus III, was imprisoned in Rome. So he kind of came in. And he didn't use terror. He used flattery, smooth promises, intrigue. He's an antichrist type in that, basically, that's how the antichrist is going to come to power. In the first 3.5 years, when he comes riding on the white horse, he comes in to save the day, and everybody just goes, hey. And then the question, we'll answer it later today, though, but is he a Jew? Is the Antichrist a Jew? Or is he just from the Roman Empire? Or is he also Jewish? So, and that's Walford does a good job on that. So here's what it says. Clark says this about him. He flattered Eumenes, the king of the Pergamos, and Attalus, his brother, got their assistance. He flattered the Romans and sent ambassadors to court their favor and pay them the amount of the tribute. He flattered the Syrians and gained their concurrence. That's kind of what he did. And again, remember, his name, Epiphanes, means the illustrious one. Okay, the illustrious one. But the Jews had another name for him. They called him Epimanes. Epimanes. And that means the madman. Okay? And he's the prince of the covenant in the next verse. The prince of the covenant is Ananias, the high priest. So let's go ahead and go there for a minute. So he's referred to in Daniel, remember, as the little horn. In Daniel 8, 9 to 14, Daniel 8, 9 to 14, and verses 23 to 25, we know he's the little horn. And, you know, he basically is a tricky guy. And under his rule, religious persecution was going to happen big time to the Jewish people. So here's what it says in verses 22 all the way to 27 now. It says, with the force of a flood they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. And after the league is made with him, he shall act decisively, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. He shall enter peaceably even unto the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil and riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds. But only for a time. He shall stir up his power and courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. Yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. Both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they will speak lies at the same table, and it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. So if I read that and was thinking about American politics, I'd go, gee, that sums it up right there. So he'll act decisively. Remember, the angel told Daniel, the vile person, in 11:21, that king of the north, the angel said, is going to be vile. So the angel's already told Daniel. And will attempt a deceitful covenant with the king of the south. So Daniel already knows this. And it'll fail. There's going to be a great battle. But it will not change the balance of power. And this all got fulfilled when Antiochus Epiphanes carried on a feud. But he pretended friendship and alliance to catch them off guard. Massive efforts and epic battles, Antiochus Epiphanes did not stand, and his army was swept away historically. In the famous battle, a Roman general drew a circle around Antiochus in the dirt and demanded to know if he would surrender and pay tribute to Rome, and demanded to know before he stepped out of the circle. From then on, there was no doubt Antiochus Epiphanes took his orders from Rome and was under Roman dominion. Okay, so that's, in other words, the defeat of Antiochus Epiphanes at his second campaign against Egypt was important because Egypt beat Antiochus Epiphanes with the help of Rome. The Roman fleet came to the assistance of Ptolemy, okay? And that's how he won, all right? So those who eat the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. This was fulfilled in the treachery against Antiochus by his own counselors who went against him. Okay? So the bottom line is that Antiochus is incredibly smooth-talking, but has to adhere to defeat after defeat on the military plane. He's not winning the battles. So instead of growing, because his goal was to be like Alexander the Great, and he wanted to conquer all the way up into Macedonia, but he didn't realize that the nation of Carthage and Rome were now becoming powerful. And so the world is dramatically changing. Okay? All right, so but going back to Antiochus in verse 22, the prince of the covenant, that's Onias, the high priest in Jerusalem, who bore that title. Jason and another rival, Menelaus and the tribe of Benjamin, both wanted the office, both wanted to introduce Greek culture and customs into temple worship. Ananias opposed the Hellenization, and his death then allowed Antiochus IV to move forward with establishing Greek culture. And that Greek culture is called the Hellenistic culture. Hellenistic. It's where the Greek gods are practiced, the religion, the democracy or the free thinking comes into play. The Hellenistic thinking is what they call it. It's all from them. The vile person in verses 28 to 35. Now, what's going to happen? We have him taking over, but now he turns on the Holy Land with violence. So while returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the Holy Covenant. And so he shall do damage and return to his own land. At the appointed time, he shall return and go toward the south, but it shall not be like the former or the latter. For ships from Cyprus shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and returned in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. And that those ships from Cyprus is the Roman fleet. Okay? The ships from Cyprus is the Roman fleet.
Is Kittim the same thing?
Huh?
Kittim. Mine says Kittim.
Kittim, same thing. Yeah. If your Bible says Kittim, then it's the ships from, it's the same thing. It's the Roman fleet. And notice what is happening. He's gonna go back, and his rage is going to be against the Holy Covenant. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress, and they shall take away the daily sacrifices, and place there the abomination of desolation. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by the sword and flame by captivity, plundering. And now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join them with intrigue. And some of those understanding shall fall and refine them, purify them, and make them white until the end of the time. The time of the end, because it is still for an appointed time. So, he says, when it says his heart shall be moved against the Holy Covenant, what's he talking about? Well, the Holy Covenant is the people and the temple of Israel. Okay? And so he comes back from this defeat, and it's after he returned from Egypt, bitter with defeat. Because the Egyptians now, aided by the ships from Kittim or Cyprus, they've turned him back, and he's ticked off. So he goes back to the very land that he already controls and starts taking it out on the Jewish people, right? So he vents his anger against Jerusalem, which was already reeling because he had sold the office of the high priest and persecuted the Jewish people to conform them to the Greek culture, forsaking the faith and traditions of their fathers. Now, failing in his invasion, he still returned home with only great plunder to smooth his wounded pride. Because even in those days, you would still take plunder. So if you took you maybe lost a battle, but you still won parts of the war. You didn't lose the entire war, you just lost parts of it. So he came back with lots of good stuff. And what's he do? Well, he literally takes away the daily sacrifices and placed there an abomination of desolation. Antiochus Epiphanes literally set up an abomination of desolation, put Zeus on the temple altar, demanded sacrifice to the image, literally forced the priest to eat swine. And then slaughtered the pig and offered it on the altar, which desecrated the temple, which means nobody could go back because it was unclean. Okay? We'll read about it from the book of the Maccabees here in a minute. He demanded sacrifice to the image. In truth, it was an abomination which brought a desolate condition to the temple, for now no one would come to worship at all. So it is an abomination, and it brought desolation because it was impure. You could not, you have to clean it. And the Maccabean revolt will end up cleaning up the whole thing. So the sixth Syrian war is when Ptolemy and Antiochus Epiphany start doing this whole thing, and it gets kind of crazy what they do. So let me talk about the fact that in chapter 11, let me finish this first and I'll come back to that. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt, but the people who know their God shall be strong. What does that mean? When he turned on Jerusalem, remember when the three refused to bow to the statue? And we said, I wonder what happened to all the other captives? What can we surmise? The rest of the captives bowed down. Now, I can imagine how they did it. They bowed down and went, Lord, I'm just doing this to save my family right now, but really I worship you, and I'm going to get up. The three guys, they didn't. So here we have the same thing. Antiochus Epiphany turns on Jerusalem, and guess who aids him? Some of the Hellenistic Jews. Okay? They forsook their covenant and embraced Greek culture. I call it the ultimate compromise. Because they had a theophany with God, okay, a oneness with God. God had revealed himself to the people. They were the chosen people, and they chose to go with what was popular at the time, the Greek culture. Kind of what we were talking about when class first started. Churches that are falling into place, following their logic, humanistic thinking, and thinking, well, we want to be more like the world so we can attract more people to us instead of taking a stand. So those who knew their God made a stand, and they were incredibly abused. He literally went in and killed all the infants in Jerusalem, then raped the women and killed the women. If he could find you, you were not going to survive. So that, and in his attack on Jerusalem, it said that he killed 80,000 Jews, took 40,000 as prisoners, and another 40,000 as slaves, and he robbed the temple of approximately $1 billion worth of gold and artifacts. Now, what does it say? Until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time, the terror could only last for as long as God had appointed it, and God had a purpose even for such persecution and blasphemy. And we've talked about how God uses things, and here he's using it to rise up the Maccabean revolt that will put down Antiochus Epiphanes, and he's given us a picture of what the future abomination of desolation will look like. Okay, so it's a close prophecy and a far away prophecy that Daniel's making in 500 BC, 530 BC basically, and it comes to pass in 170 BC. Okay? So, the Antichrist, the last days. Okay? So what happens now in this chapter is you got to divide it in two. Okay, starting in verse 32, which we just kind of went over, it's now talking about the Maccabean revolt. So Daniel's divided in two parts. The first part that we've done up to verse 32 covers the time period from the Persian kingdom all the way to Antiochus Epiphanes. So we have the five kings. We have the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. All that now is done. Does that make sense? Are we with me? Okay? All right. Now, verse 32 to 35 covers the time. Those three verses cover the time of the Maccabean rebellion against the pagan Greek culture. Antiochus IV was a type of the coming end-time world leader, and the Maccabean kind of are acting out the part of what future righteous Jews who would reject the end time in the Great Tribulation also. The 144,000 that preach and save so many. Okay? So, and thus bring his last day's assault, resulting in the coming of the Messiah. So verse 32, those who do wickedly against the covenant he shall corrupt with flattery. The temple became a test for those in Israel. Those who aligned themselves with Antiochus showed their wickedness. Okay? Daniel 11 draws a contrast between the two groups of people. Those who know God and understand, and the wicked who act against God. This line does not stop with the Maccabeans, but will continue all the way till the end of time, and we see it aligning right now. Those that are standing with God and those that want to compromise. And then you have the ones that are absolutely anti-God. Okay? This pattern was set in Daniel chapter 8. We are told about the coming abomination of desolation, who would desecrate the temple. Antiochus is merely a picture of a future and greater defiler who is coming in the end of days. And the end of days is with quotation marks around it, because that would be end of days is the great tribulation period and right before the Messiah comes back for Israel. Okay? So, the Jews compelled under the penalty of death, they literally, this is what it says, in Maccabean 1:30 and 2 Maccabee 5:24, Maccabee 1:30 and 2 Maccabee 5:24, you're supposed to say, Gary, why are we reading a book of the Apocrypha? Well, I just want to read what it says. It's a really great historical look at it, okay? Since most of us aren't going to read 1 and 2 Maccabees, okay? All right, history tells us that a small band of Jewish patriots fought against him. That's, of course, in 1132. Verse 1132, the people that know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. Well, here's how it happened. Here's what it says in the book. Now, it came to pass after 2 years, in the 145th year, okay, on the 25th day of the month, which is called by Chazlu, by the Macedonians, Apollos, in the 153rd Olympiad, that a king came up to Jerusalem, and pretending peace, he got possession of the city by treachery, at which time he spared not so much as those that admitted him to it, on account of the riches that lay in the temple, but led by a covetous inclination, for he saw that there was a great deal of gold and many ornaments that had been dedicated to it of very great value. And in order to plunder its wealth, he ventured to break the league which he made. So he left the temple bare, took away the golden candlesticks, the golden altar of incense, the table of showbread, and the altar of burnt offering, and did not abstain from even the veils, which were made of fine linen and scarlet. He also emptied it of his treasures and left nothing at all remaining. By this means cast the Jews into great lamentation, for he forbade them to offer those daily sacrifices which they used to offer to God according to the law. And when he had pillaged the whole city, some of the inhabitants he slew, and some he carried captive, together with their wives and children, so that the multitude of these captives were taken alive amounted to over 10,000. He also burnt down the finest buildings, and when he had overthrown the city walls, he built a citadel in the lower part of the city, for the place was high and overlooked the temple. On account, he fortified it with high walls and towers and put into it a garrison of Macedonians. Because he was aligned, remember, with the other general who was up in Macedonia, which is above Greece. Okay? However, in that citadel dwelt the impious and wicked part of the Jewish multitude, for whom it proved that the citizens suffered many and sore calamities. And when the king had built an altar upon God's altar, he slew swine upon it, and so offered a sacrifice neither according to the law or the Jewish religion in that country. He also compelled them to forsake the worship which they paid their own God and to adore those who took to be gods, and them build temples, raise idol altars in every city and village, and offer swine upon them every day. So the book of the Maccabees tells the story of the brave Jews who battled Antiochus, finally bringing him to reign. It's centered around a man named Matthias, okay, home about 17 miles outside Jerusalem in 167 B.C. After the desecration, a guerrilla war ensued, okay, and of course, the bottom line is that Matthias' son, Judas Maccabeus, successfully recaptured Jerusalem, and he reconsecrated the temple. That happened in 164 B.C., and he did it through infiltration. And, of course, that's where we get the celebration of Hanukkah, because the oil was supposed to only last, it needed to last 8 days, but they only had enough for one day, but it ended up lasting 8 days. Okay? So, in verses 33 to 35, and those of the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by the sword, etc. So many, the devoted Jews we're talking about here, that's the many. The many in that verse is talking about the killed in the Maccabean revolt. Okay? And it set an example for future Israel. We see here a period of persecution is long and involves many days and many people. Now, remember we talked about how upset Daniel was? The more you read this and understand what Daniel would have known, he would have seen his people suffering all these things, and it bothered him to a great deal. Okay? He's looking at this futuristic thing saying, that's not what I pictured when Nehemiah went back to build the walls and Ezra went back to build the temple. I thought it was all going to be good, but you're telling me, God, it's going to be bad, and on top of that, it's going to go all the way till the end of time, till the Messiah comes, because he's been cut off. Remember back in chapter 9, till Messiah is cut off. So he's really, he's kind of crazy. In verse 34, it says, now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue. As some Jews were killed in the Maccabean revolt, others provided little help. Many joined by intrigue, that is, they joined insincerely. They really weren't part of it. You know what I'm saying? So during the time gap, many will make the choice of joining those who understand or joining those are in rebellion against God. Verse 35, and some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them, purify them, and make them white until the time of the end. Some of the understanding refers to those who understand God's word and were allowed to go through troubled times so they can be refined and purified. That's always what happens to people that are suffering for God's sake. It's because we're being purified. We're being made more like Him. And then it says refine. This period is a time of refining where the people of God are made white by the trials of life. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't like trials. But they're a necessity because God says they're a necessity. So when I teach biblical counseling at 7 o'clock, I'm always teaching that trials are part of what we go through. Pain is part of being a Christian. It's we're the only people that can explain why life is hard. The rest of the world can't explain why there's bad things. They just go run away from it, try to get away from it. We can look at it and be okay with it. So, until the time of the end, this purification will continue till the end. The time of the end, get this now. Everybody do with me. The time of the end, in quotation marks, is all the way from Daniel 11, verse 36, to Daniel 12, verse 2. Because when we get to the first two verses of Daniel chapter 12, we're going to see that Michael has to come to the aid of Israel, and we're talking about the great tribulation, because we're going to get into Revelation where Satan and Michael have a war in heaven. Okay? All right. So, suddenly in verse 36, we have this willful king, and it's a shift to a future fulfillment, the last days of Antiochus Epiphanes. Then the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished, for what has been determined shall be done. He shall exalt and magnify. The angel explained to Daniel that this king will blaspheme God and exalt himself until the wrath has been accomplished and what has been determined shall be done. And here we shift from what was fulfilled in the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, and we look ahead now because it's going to be fulfilled in the Antichrist, the final world dictator. And this was told to Daniel when Daniel was told about the latter days. So go to Daniel 10:14 and see what it says. Daniel 10, verse 14. Somebody read it.
And came to make you understand what is happening.
Real loud so I can hear you.
Okay. And came to make you understand what is to happen to your people in the latter days. For the vision is for days yet to come.
Yeah, so latter days is both a close prophecy, because it's going to talk about Antiochus Epiphanes, that we have the historical part happening right in front of us. But it's also talking about when Michael goes to war with the angels of Satan, and there's a great battle, and we're entering now into the tribulation period. Okay? And look at Daniel 11, verse 36. It begins to look towards this final world dictator who is a sort of the last days of Antiochus Epiphanes. So we know that everything was not fulfilled during the career of Antiochus Epiphanes. How do we know that? Because Jesus specifically said that the real abomination of desolation was still in the future. And now you've got to think, when did the abomination of desolation happen? In about 167 BC, 167 years pass, Jesus is born, 33 years, he does a prophecy called the Olivet Discourse, and he says this. Matthew 24:15 is where you'll find it. Matthew 24:15 is Jesus talking about the real abomination of desolation. And Paul paraphrased it, okay, in 2 Thessalonians 2:3-4. 2 Thessalonians 3-4. Paul paraphrases this verse in 11:36 of Daniel. He says, let no one deceive you by any means, for that day, what day? A latter day, will not come unless the falling away comes first, and the man of sin or perdition is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. What did Epiphanes put in the... He put in Zeus. What will the Antichrist put in the temple?
Himself.
Himself. So we have a close prophecy and a far prophecy. Are you with me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Antiochus is important mostly as a historical preview of the Antichrist. He's a type. That's why so much space has been given to him in chapter 8 and chapter 11, because he's prefiguring the ultimate evil man. He is the trailer, movie trailer, for what is going to come when the real movie is released. Okay, the featured movie is going to be the Antichrist. Does that make sense? Okay. Antiochus Epiphanes certainly magnified himself in a general sense that all sinners oppose God. Yet he remained loyal to the Greek religious tradition and and he revered the Olympian pantheon of gods. Antiochus Epiphanes put a statue of Zeus in the temple, not of himself. This will be far more precisely fulfilled because it's he will sit as God, 2 Thessalonians 2:4. Literally, he will say, I am God, worship me. He will be the big I will be as God. And that happens at the 3.5 year middle of the Great Tribulation because it's the 70th week of Daniel. And it said in chapter 9 that in the middle of the week, it would end. Okay? That's what it's saying. Does it all come together? Okay. Now, Antichrist will do much damage, but he's on a short chain and will only work into God's plan. God's purpose will be accomplished. Okay? Now, verses 37 to 39. Okay? A lot of controversy here. So, Walford had his opinion, so we'll kind of like talk about all of them. The character and the authority of this willful king. Now, what are we talking about? Is this a future person, or is this Antiochus Epiphanes? It's a future person, right? He shall regard neither the God of his fathers nor the desire of the woman. Now, people take that, the God of his fathers, that's where they get the idea that he's Jewish. Still part of the Roman Empire, because Paul was a Roman, right? Okay? Nor the desire of women. Then people read that and they go, well, he's going to be a homosexual. Okay? Or nor regard any God. So he'll be of a, well, you can worship God in your way. Let me worship him in my way. You can be, we can all get along, like that bumper sticker that has all the religions on it.
Oh, I hate that.
Let the coexist one. That's kind of what's saying here. So he's not really going to, regard for any God. He's just going to go, can we all just get along? Okay? And he shall exalt himself above them all at that 3.5. But in their place he shall honor a god of fortresses, and a god which his fathers did not know shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. Thus he shall act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign god, which he shall acknowledge and advance its glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain. Okay? So you have, out of this time tunnel, in the end of days, with the final king of the Gentile world in charge, that's 1136 all the way to 12:2. The king here is the future king at the end of time, the last king of the Gentile powers, and the final king before the return of Messiah. This king is the ruler of the kingdom, pictured as the iron and the clay toes in Daniel 2:44. The revived Roman Empire, who will be headed up by who? By the Antichrist, okay? Now, he shall neither regard the God of his fathers nor desire of women, okay? So, let me go back to Daniel 2:44. And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven shall set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. He is the little horn of Daniel 7 who uproots three of his fellows, the other three, okay? The final earthly kingdom before the kingdom is going to be 10 toes, three of which he will uproot and control, and then he'll control the whole package, okay? All right? And don't forget that Daniel 7:8, and there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words. Daniel 7, verse 8. Who was that talking about in Daniel 7, verse 8? It's talking about the pompous Antichrist. Okay? All right. And again, the 10 horns are 10 kings, and another shall rise after them. He'll be different from the first ones. He shall subdue three of them, and he shall speak pompous words against the Most High God, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and they shall intend to change times and law, and then the saint shall be given into his hand for a time, and a time, and a half time. That's the 3.5 years of the tribulation. That's in Daniel 7, 24 to 25. So again, going back to, will neither regard the God of his fathers nor the desire of women. Based on this, some people, biblical scholars, believe that he'll be of Jewish descent and perhaps will also be a homosexual. These things may not be popularly known about the man, but they may be true nonetheless. Many commentators believe the desire of women refers to Jesus in that women desired the honor of bearing Messiah, and understanding desire as it's used in Haggai 2:7, seeing the desire of woman as Jesus makes most sense of it in light of the flow of the context, but I'm not going that direction. He shall honor a God of fortunes. The Antichrist will take and hold power with mighty might and shrewd use of great riches. He literally will take of the 10 nations, he will conquer 3 and control the other 7, and he will be the leader of this great army. Now, in the Ezekiel 38:39, we have Gog and Magog coming down. I'll get there in a minute. But just before I even get there, what you're going to have is, remember, we have the kings of the north and the south, right? But we're also going to have kings of the east, okay? And we're going to have kings of the west. And the west is going to be represented by Europe, okay? And that's going to be the Antichrist. The east will be some army, get this number now, according to Revelation, it will field 200 million men. And it'll cross the Euphrates, which will be dried up so they can cross with no possibility of problem. The northern army that comes down and goes into Israel, okay, is Russia. And the southern army, if you look today, what is in the south? It is all under Israel. It's what? Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, Yemen, all the Muslim nations. So you're going to have the Muslims go up against the Russians. Then the east is going to come, and then the west is going to come, and that is the battle of Armageddon in the Valley of Megiddo. Okay? And we're going to get there in a second, so I just wanted to kind of give us a highlight of where we're heading. Now, it says the God of fortresses, the God of fortresses, listen, you've got to be a pretty powerful army to defeat 200 million men, to defeat the Russians, who God will defeat with his hand, basically. By the way, where do you think the Jewish people are in this? Well, Zechariah says that only a third of them will survive. So how many Jews are in the world? I think 11 million, 12 million. And in Israel, it's 5 million, maybe 6 million. The rest are still not brought back yet. Only a third will survive. Where do they survive at? The Mount of Olives will be split in two. Head down this valley into a city called Petra. Petra is the only place in that land that can house 1 million people.
That's really far.
It's 1 million people. Yeah, but when you're, what did Jesus say in the Olivet Discourse? Whatever you're doing, when you see the abomination of desolation, drop whatever you're doing and flee. Because if you read Ezekiel 38 and 39, at this same time, the battle of Gog and Magog, you're looking at probably a huge nuclear problem. And God is going to miraculously save that remnant of Jewish people and get them to the city of Petra, where they can hide in those caves and survive the onslaught. Now, it doesn't take much. I'm a Star Wars nut. So I already know that the that in Star Wars, the Emperor had machines that could take the power of a planet and build a screen that nothing could penetrate around a whole planet. So why couldn't God put a magic umbrella over the people marching to Petra the whole time where nothing could touch them?
I just think that's awfully far, though, to go from...
It is. It's
far.
It's far, but it's not as far as you'd really think it is.
But it's think about the Israelites with Moses. It was short, but 40 years he did this for them.
Yeah.
It's a short Disney.
40 years to go 40 miles.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. The final conflict, verses 40 to 45. Now, I gave you the scenario all at once. Now let me explain it. At the time of the end of the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships. Now, by the way, in the Hebrew language, okay, what they call a chariot is called a battle tank. They actually call their tanks in Israel chariots. Okay? And shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. He shall also enter the glorious land. Uh-oh. What's the glorious land?
Israel.
And many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand. Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. Well, who are and where today is Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon?
Jordan.
What nation is that?
Jordan.
And what nation houses Petra?
Jordan.
Bingo. He shall stretch out his hand against these countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape, and he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over the precious things of Egypt. By the way, where it says the precious things of Egypt, they say that in Egypt, unfound up to this day, is still the wealth of the pharaohs that has been buried and no one has yet to find it. Suppose they found the wealth of all, they say that 50 to 60% of all the gold went to the pharaohs in Egypt when they were in control, and it's still there, they never found. That's why everybody's trying to dig for the stuff in Egypt all the time. So, or what if they discovered oil? Right now they haven't, but what if they did? Okay, and also the Libyans and the Ethiopians, that is the land of Cush. Cush is the grandson of Noah. He's the father of all black people. So we say Libyans and Ethiopians, but it would have been Cush and Put. Okay? But news from the east, who did I say the east is?
Europe.
It's a 200 million man army. Now, what nation living today has an army or can put into the field a 200 million man army?
China.
China already advertises that. If you go to Jane's books on warfare, they already list it as a common fact that they could put 200 million people. What is the only... Go back up to this part. You're going to crack up at this. And the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships. What is the only nation on earth that still has a division is over, I think a division is, somebody look it up on the computer real quick. A division, I think, is 10,000 men? Or is it bigger than that? How large is a division? I should have looked that up. I think it's between 6 and 10,000.
10,000 to 15,000.
10,000?
10,000 to 15,000.
Okay, so 10 to 15,000. Okay, now, what army in today's world still has a working cavalry of 30,000 plus horses and arms that they could put 30,000 horse soldiers into battle?
It's from the north. It must be
Russia. Russia today still has two divisions of horse soldiers. And if you're going to fight a war coming from the north through Turkey, around the Black Sea, and try to run roughshod over Syria, Turkey, and into Israel, what kind of terrain are you going to be fighting on? Mountainous terrain where a tank's not going to do you any good. But if you've got, do we have anything like that? Nope. 30,000 plus horses ready to go in a minute's notice. Now, here it is, biblically speaking, right there. Okay, also, but news from the east, that would be that 200 million, and the north shall trouble them, because the north's coming down, and the east coming over this way, and the nation of the north and the south are coming up, and the one in the west is going to say, wait a minute, what's going on here? I got to get into this battle, I'm going to lose. Okay? And they shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. So here's what it says. At the time of the end, the angel described to Daniel a confederation of kings coming against this great leader. Who's the great leader? The Antichrist. With a battle in and near the Holy Land. Prophetically speaking, a precise identification of peoples is difficult. The king of the south may be Egypt or represent the Arab community. I believe it represents the Arab community as a whole, outside of Jordan. The king of the north may be the Antichrist domain, okay, the new Antichrist Epiphanes, but Ezekiel calls it Gog and Magog. It's Russia. It's Rush. Okay? The points may be cloudy, but the general idea is clear. The end will be marked by a huge conflict culminating in the world's armies gathered at the promised land to do final battle. If I'm a leader of any of these countries, I'm going to read this chapter and go, well, at least I know where the final battle is going to be. Let's get our tanks and artillery settled on Megiddo so we can win the battle there. I'm not going to be a dummy. If I'm a general, I'm looking at it. Then it says, yet he should come to his end and no one will help him. In the end, there is no help for the Antichrist or any of his followers, okay? So what's going to happen is, the bottom line is that this great war, no one can help. Because it's all orchestrated by God. Now, everybody go to Ezekiel 38, 39 real quick. Now, remember I said last week, and I said it was a Garyism, so you can't take it to the bank? So in the chapters that preceded this, it's the Valley of Dry Bones, chapter 37. Basically, the bones are given life, they give breath. That's the repopulation of Israel. Now look at chapter 38. A prophecy against God. And again, I told you, I thought my guess is it's that's pre-trib or right after the rapture. Either one would fit. Okay? I just don't want to be around for either one. Okay? Here's what it says. Now the word of the Lord came to me saying, son of man, set your face against Gog, and of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal, the prophecy against him, and say, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am against you, O Gog, the prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. If you look up those words historically, that's up in the above Turkey, above into the where Georgia is today, all that land. Yeah, you've got it right there on the map. Yeah. So it's right there, okay? And I will turn you around, put hooks in your jaws, and lead you out with all your army horses and horsemen, all splendidly clothed, a great company of bucklers and shields, all of them handling swords, okay? Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya, which is Put, with them, all of them with shield and helmet, Gomer and all its troops, to the house of Togarmah, that was Turkey, from the far north, and all his troops, many people are with you. And it, in the next two verses, chapter 7 and 8, it says, in the latter years you will come into the land of those brought back from the sword and gathered from many people on the mountains of Israel, which had long been desolate. They were brought out of the nations, and now all of them will dwell safely. So it's going to come when Israel is dwelling safely. Well, what do we already know in the first 3.5 years of the tribulation? Who comes on the scene and delivers the false peace? The Antichrist. So this very well could happen, because we're not mentioned as a nation here, okay? The bottom line is, where is America? You know, we're not even mentioned. It's like we're like, you know, is it pre-trib or in the first 3 years? In the Hebrew word, for safety, it's bechach, B-E-T-A-C-H. It means dwell in safety. The bottom line is that we have these nations mentioned to us. Rosh is the ancient known as Rosho or Raspa or Rosh, that's Russia. Magog is an ancient Scythian city, and that's Central Asia. The Republic of former Soviet Union, with a population of 60 million Muslims, this territory could even include modern Afghanistan. So the Scythians, if you go above Turkey and head east, that's all that mountainous range up there, okay? Meshach and Musco, it would be another name for Moscow, all right? Turkey and southern Russia and Iran. Tubal, okay, is Turkey, okay? Iran, you know, changed its name from Persia to Iran in 1935, all right? And then I told you who Cush was, the Ethiopians, south of Egypt, that's the Sudan, and Libya of Put. Literally, all of those nations will come together on this great battle. Now, the question is, when is this great battle? That part we just don't know. I'm, again, guessing the best I can make an educated guess. It either happens right before the pre-tribulation time, before the rapture, and we see it, or it seems to me more plausible once the restrainer is removed that there's nothing to stop these nations from acting totally evil, because there's no prayer warriors anywhere restraining anything. So now all the plans come in. So my guess, it's right after the rapture. And this huge army happens all in the first 3.5 years before the abomination of desolation. Because somebody has to win out. So Russia comes down, defeats the Muslims. That question's answered. The East comes against the Russians. The Russians are defeated by God himself, because he saves the people of Israel into Petra. The 200 come across the Euphrates, met by the army of the Antichrist. He comes in, squelches the whole thing, rides into Jerusalem and proclaims himself God, because he saved the whole world. Thus endeth the story. Okay, let's take a break. We'll come back. Okay, can everybody hang in there 30 more minutes? It's good stuff. Okay. Let me take us back. The future king was pictured in Daniel chapter 8, foreshadowed by Antiochus Epiphanes by desecrating the future temple, the third temple. We saw all that in Daniel 7:24-25, when Daniel talked about the saints will be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time, which is 3.5 years. Well, in Daniel 8:23, it says this, "And in the later time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, that is, all the Gentile nations, a king shall arise having fierce features who understands sinister schemes." We know that from chapter 11, that that's Antiochus Epiphanes. The end time, also referred to in Daniel chapter 9, is also referred to as the prince to come. A descendant of the armies which destroyed Jerusalem and the temple in AD 70, which of course was Titus and the Roman Empire, which then relates the future guy to be part of that new Roman Empire, whatever it's going to be, that 10 nation of the 10 toes, that confederation, whatever that is. Most people believe that when the European Union got set up and we had the 10 main, that was it. Mm-hmm. And of course now with Brexit and everything, that's falling apart as we look at it. Belgium's going to get out. Ireland's probably going to get out. You know, Germany wants out badly because they're paying for everything. So that may not be the 10 confederation, so it may be something else now. Okay? But I can readily see 10 nations joining together, forming a confederacy, and then coming up. It wouldn't be that hard to do. So now, he guarantees what happens in chapter 9 of verse 26 and 27 of Daniel. Let me read it. "And after the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. And the end of it shall be with a flood, and till the end of the war, desolations are determined. And then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week." That's the 69th week, because you already had the 7 weeks, the 62 weeks. Messiah got cut off. What happened after Messiah in 33 AD? He goes to the cross. He's resurrected. What did he predict? He said, "Believe me, I'm going to rise again in 3 days. I'll rebuild this temple in 3 days." He was talking about his body. They all thought he was talking about the temple. And he says, "Listen, a stone will not be left upon a stone, and you could go to Israel today and see the stones still on the ground. They're there. No one's picked them up. They're still where they pushed them off the side. Now, lots of the other stones have been moved to build other walls and stuff, but those stones have remained right there where the Romans, where the bridge used to be that went over, the big bridge that went across.
They're huge.
Yeah, just huge rocks right down there. And so the bottom line is that he literally breaks the agreement and desecrates the temple at midpoint after 3.5 years. Okay? This prophecy is not yet fulfilled. What follows Daniel 11:36 to 39 are descriptive qualifiers about this end time ruler. First, we find he acts according to his own will. He is the fulfillment of the Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Humanism taken to its logical conclusion. Man acting according to his own will and not the will of God or any deity but his own. Okay? He magnifies himself. Revelation 13:14-15 says this about him. Revelation 13:14-15. "And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived." Because he's going to get a wound that normally would kill any human being, and he's going to be able to come back, basically copying Christ coming back from the dead. Okay? "He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast." Okay, so that thing in the temple is actually going to come alive. People are going to be freaked out. Okay? "That the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not to worship the image of the beast to be killed." So if they don't worship, they're going to get killed. Okay? So the blasphemy, another characteristic of this man is his hostility toward God. So here's the characteristics of the Antichrist. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god. He will speak blasphemies against God. He will prosper until the end of the 3.5 years, and he's put down by Jesus Christ. So he'll prosper. He will not regard the God of his fathers. We already talked about that. In fact, he will not regard any God, which leads me to throw this out. What do we see happening in the world right now?
No religion
or a one world religion, accepting of everybody's religion in one little group.
Except,
you know?
Except.
Except Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we see it playing out. Okay? And Revelation 13:6 says, Revelation 13:6, he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. And shall prosper, the Hebrew word tishlach, T-S-A-L-A-C-H, tishlach, means to rush, to advance, prosper, make profit, succeed, be profitable. He'll be unstoppable until the determined time is complete. And what do we know, we hear about all the time? What's going to happen? Once the abomination of desolation, once that happens, what does everybody have to have in order to do business in the world?
Silence.
They have to have the mark of the beast. So it's going to be a world order, economically and militarily, all controlled by the Antichrist. And Daniel's been told this whole thing. In Daniel 7:25, he literally is told, till the wrath. This period is stated, it's going to actually be 42 months or 1,260 days. What does that add up to? 3.5 years. So the midpoint of the tribulation. It's found both in Daniel and Revelation. Daniel's 7 weeks is divided into 2 3.5 year periods. According to the Jewish year, these periods would be about 1,260 days, 3.5 years, 42 months, or what's that phrase again? A time and time and half a time. Because a time is 3.5. Okay? All right. Accomplished. Daniel informed Daniel 3 years earlier that the 77s, or the 490 years, were to be determined on his people. At the conclusion of the last half of the last seven, the wrath will be complete. Daniel 11:36 to verse 12:2, chapter 12, verse 2, those verses are all talking about the last 7 years of the 70 weeks. Okay? So what's this final world religion? We talked about the fact the king will cast aside the God of his fathers and the worship of his ancestors. Daniel gives us insight into the religious background of the last king. The statement, God of his fathers, has been subject to much debate. Based on this verse, some have concluded that the Antichrist will have a Jewish background. However, the word for God here is Elohim, not Jehovah. This means he will not believe in the God of his descendants, but he will exalt himself above all that that is called God. And basically, the Messiah was promised to come from the seed of a woman, Genesis 3:15. Genesis 3:15. This king would not regard the Messiah. In other words, he would not regard the God of his fathers, the desire of women. We know because Daniel 9:26, he will be a descendant of the armies. Here's a kicker now. This is why I don't believe he's going to be Jewish. If you go to Daniel 9:26, it says he will be a descendant of the armies, part of that confederation of 10 nations, which destroyed the temple and Jerusalem, a new Roman Empire, a Roman. Based on these words, some have concluded the Antichrist could it be very well be a homosexual because he will not have desire of women. But nevertheless, what this verse says he will not regard is that desire of women, not he will desire women. The bottom line is he's going to be from the Roman Empire. I have a problem with him being Jewish because if he's Jewish, what people will not follow him? The armies of the south. So in the first 3.5 years when he tries to bring peace, what nations will be totally against him?
The Muslims.
The Muslims.
Yeah.
But you know what? He could be only be and not be, not have it known. You know, have it not known.
Oh, he could keep it secret, yeah, but yeah, that's always a possibility. But in this day and age when everything is known, I'm just saying, I think it's more that he's going to come out of the Roman Empire, very well could be out of Ireland, could be out of England, could be out of Spain, out of Italy, and he's going to be able to speak pompous words that everybody can follow before these great armies meet. So the armies don't meet till that later time. So, okay? And the bottom line is that, remember I talked about that he's going to have, he will literally recover from a great wound, so that everybody will look at him like, this is a super guy. We need to follow him. Look at, he's come back from the dead. He's going to have a wound to his head, pronounced dead, and then basically is healed from it. Okay? We see that in Revelation 13, verse 3 and 4. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast, so they worshiped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him? So we're going to have all these things just coming into play. All these checkers are lining up. All the dominoes are lining up. Okay? Remember, rule over many. The backdrop of this verse, in verse 40, we just went over, that it's a covenant of the king, the Antichrist, will make with Israel. It's the time of the end, refers to the period just before the return of Christ. So that has to be after the 3.5 years desolation of abomination. So we're happening after that. Okay? And he enters the glorious land, and then he's going to conquer Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia. And the final war erupts, Daniel 40 to 43. That's when all those armies come together. Remember that formally these kings were mentioned in the context of the Seleucid and the Ptolemy empires. Okay? They are now in relation to an end time conflict against the king, whoever that king is, in verse 36. The time of this conflict is midpoint of the tribulation period. We know from Daniel 12:1 that we're going to read right now, it says this, a future time of trouble for Israel. At that time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people, and there shall be such a time of trouble, such as never there was a nation even of that time. At that time, it describes in Daniel 12:1, is subsequent to what's happened in 11:36 to 45. Okay? Michael is associated as a spiritual battler. In Jude 1:9, we have Michael protecting the body of Moses. Okay? So why is Michael protecting the body of Moses? Because Moses has to show up at what? In Revelation, he and Elijah have to be there. So Moses' body is important to Satan. He wants to get it, so it thwarts God's plan. That's how I pretty much am convinced that Moses is one of the elders that comes back, and Elijah's probably the other one. Could be somebody else, but I don't think so. So now, the bottom line is that we also see it in Revelation 12:7. Revelation 12:7. What happens in Revelation 12:7? We have a great war going on in heaven. People always ask me, they go, well, why is I thought Satan was in hell. That was his home. His home isn't in hell until the end of the tribulation period when he's cast down there. Revelation 12, Job tells us that he walks around accusing the brethren in heaven on a constant basis. So he has access to God's throne room. So 12:7, and war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon. Of course, the dragon is Satan. And the dragon and his angels fought, but they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old, called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast where? To the earth. That's why the tribulation is not going to be a great place to be. Because he's got no place to win anymore except down here. So Michael is the guardian of the Jewish people. He's Satan's true opposite. Satan is not the opposite of Jesus. He's the opposite of Michael. A lot of religions teach that he's on equal par. He's a created being just like you and I are. That's why in spiritual warfare, we can ask the Lord to bind Satan, and he's bound. He hates the name of Jesus. The great prince is a special job. Michael has that job protecting Israel. And what kind of trouble is it? This refers to the time of Jacob's trouble in Jeremiah 30, verse 7. Jeremiah 30, verse 7. It's called the Great Tribulation. And there never was a time. Now think about what Israel's gone through. They were defeated. The fall of Samaria and Jerusalem under Babylon, under the Assyrians, under the Hittites, right? Then you have Antiochus Epiphanes. Then you have the Romans coming on, destroying the temple and dispersing them throughout the world in 70 AD. Then you have the Catholic Church during the Dark Ages attacking the Jews. If you read Luther's historical perspective, he had a tremendous dislike for the Jewish people because I think everybody is, I keep saying this, all the prophets, including Luther, were able to see the peaks of all God's stuff, but never saw the valleys. And so he just couldn't rationalize why the Jews would have not accepted their Messiah. So he blamed them for killing the Messiah. I like the song when we sing it that says, my sins put him there. You know, I'm the one that put Jesus on the cross, not the Jews. You know, in fact, we all did. Every human being put Jesus on the cross. So, and then you have, of course, the 20th century Holocaust, and you have what we're seeing today, the rise of anti-Semitism. In fact, if someone were to ask me, give me one solid proof that you could take to a courtroom to show me that the nation of Israel and the Jewish people are God's chosen people, I would simply read a history of the Jewish people to the judge and say, you're going to tell me that a roll of the dice caused this much trouble to this particular people from time immortal till now? I mean, Abraham had problems as being the first Hebrew. They wanted to kill him. So don't tell me. The circumstantial evidence is overwhelming. It's just overwhelming. And it'll be a worse trouble than Israel's ever seen before. And this is what Jesus said about it in Matthew 24:21. Again, Matthew 24 is the Olivet Discourse. Then there will be a great tribulation, such as not been seen since the beginning of the world until this time. No, nor shall ever be. With great sadness, we must say that the Bible teaches that the worst has yet to come for Israel and the Jewish people. because they are living in disbelief. You guys have been to Tel Aviv, right?
No.
Right?
No.
Well, you guys didn't go to Tel Aviv at all?
No.
I've been there.
So when you were in Tel Aviv, did you feel like you were in Las Vegas?
Yeah, it's very secular.
I mean, we saw stuff on the ground that was just like, what the heck? I'm in Israel. You know, because I went from Jerusalem, and Liz and I went to Tel Aviv. We stayed a day and a half in Tel Aviv.
And it's a gay capital right now.
It was like going from God's country to Satan's country. It was horrible. I couldn't wait to get out of Tel Aviv.
Yep.
You know, it just was totally secular. So, and we were there on Shabbat.
Oh, yeah.
We were there on Shabbat. It was like...
Shabbat wasn't even...
It was like... Okay, this restaurants and everybody were doing it, but the people were still walking around doing stuff. It was like, you're not even celebrating your own. Now, whereas in Israel, I'm sorry, in Jerusalem,
yeah.
it was shut down. I mean, it was like at 6 o'clock that night, you know, unless you went to a Muslim facility to get something to eat, it was closed. In Tel Aviv, you could give whatever you wanted, unless you were talking to a real Jewish homeowner or establishment. The phrase establishes its connection with the final of Great Tribulation. It can only be one time of trouble. There can't be two times of trouble or three times of trouble. Jesus is talking about one. What will make it so terrible? Well, we just read it in chapter 12. The trumpets, the seals, the bowls are all described the horrific conditions of the world in general during this time. I happen to believe that if we studied Revelations, you would see that the first set of wrath of God, if you read those, they're all almost natural catastrophes, maybe based on a war. So you could see the famine after a great war. You could see all those other things, a nuclear holocaust, all that. The pollution in the oceans, all that. I'm looking at San Onofre. They want to bury millions of radiation on the water. And I'm going, okay, I have no problem with nuclear power. I really don't. But at least let's go store it in the middle of the, Mojave Desert. You know, let's not put it down by water. That's kind of crazy. Saw what happened to the earthquake in Japan.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I can see the whole ocean being polluted. So you can just kind of picture everything that's happening. So and what's the biggest reason, though? It's because where is Satan? He's up here now, but he has nowhere to go once he's cast out by Michael. And he and his angels have nowhere else to exist but down here on a full-time basis. So then you can see where the wrath of God is going to be. He's going to use Satan to pour out his wrath. Okay? The Jew always has been a target of Satan. He has sought to destroy them. Because Satan knows that God has ordained the nation of Israel, and thus Satan has attempted in times past to destroy the nation of Israel in order to thwart the promises of God. But they're promised a deliverance. And the promise is in Genesis 17:7, and we'll stop there. The promise to Abraham, and I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you and their generation for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and your descendants after you. Bottom line is, the promise to Abraham is real. He is not forgotten his people. It's just that this gives me great hope, because we're told that we're not appointed to wrath. And everything we've read in Daniel is saying that the Israeli nation has been appointed to wrath. Well, that's why I'm standing firm that Ezekiel 38 and 39 either happen right before I get taken up or right after I get taken up. I'm not going to be here. I don't have to worry about the mark of the beast. I told a guy the other day he was worried about, you know, putting a chip in his dog. It was kind of like the mark of the beast. And I said, if I had a child today, in this day and age, I would have no problem putting a chip in my child. in case they got kidnapped or anything, I'd be able to find them. I'd be able to identify them. It has nothing to do with, it's no different than having a MasterCard or a Visa card. They are vehicles that may be used later on, but until the Antichrist is established, until he says, hey, I'm here, and he's revealed and the restrainer is taken out, that's when it'll make a big difference. Up until then, it's just the way things are going. We're going to have, if you read Obamacare, there's a section in Obamacare which has everybody implanted with a device so they can read your medical record.
Yeah.
So it's like, those things don't scare me. What scares me is if the Son of Perdition were revealed and I'm still here.
Yeah, but you don't know what they can do with it if you haven't already in it.
Well, yeah, that's true. I'd rather be a prepper. I'd rather be a prepper. We're going to stop there, and we're going to talk about, and everyone found written in the book. Not every Jewish person will be saved. Yet Israel as a whole will be known as a people who trust in Jesus their Messiah and truly turn to the Lord. We find that in Romans 11, 25 to 27. They will return, and Zechariah speaks of the same thing. Zechariah says, we will ask, who gave you these wounds? And Jesus will say to them, I got these in the house of my friends. In other words, they will recognize their Messiah. But it'll take all this war, all this great tribulation, all this killing to bring them to that point. Which leads me to always think, when people say, well, I'm just going to go to hell and party with my friends, I just go, then you haven't read Revelation, because there is no party. You know, Satan has nowhere to go. He's got no home left. He's kicked out. So, again, Daniel is completely distraught by this whole thing. He can't fathom his nation under this kind of wrath and this kind of persecution. And that's why every time we see it, he's just in complete distraught. But that's what Daniel 11 tells us. And then now we're in chapter 12. We'll finish that up next week. So anybody want to bring any food next week? Feel free.
If somebody has extra time, be sure to get her paper.
So any questions for me on 7, 8, 9, 10, 11? Because I don't have any answers. But the charts I gave you tonight, if you look at those charts, the light bulb will just go off, because you can see the comparison of chapter 2, chapter 7, chapter 8, chapter 11. And 11, think of it this way, 11 is how we understand chapter 8. Chapter 8 is how we understand chapter 2. So we probably should have studied backwards. Like I said, Walford, we should have just gone backwards. But the bottom line is, Daniel is so rich, and history has shown that he was absolutely right through 6 civil wars. Yeah. And you have that on the picture, the chart. 6 civil wars, he literally named who was going to be in charge, what nation, what relationship. Again, the circumstantial evidence, nobody could do that and get that right. And that's why Walford makes the point. That's why people are dedicated to destroying Daniel as a legitimate book, because he got the history after it was completed. But, of course, the Qumran scrolls thwarted their entire effort, because they found one complete book of Daniel all the way. And that means it was written way before they would have put it in the Qumran vaults. So. All right. Lord, thank you again for this time. Lord, thank you for getting us through chapter 11, a difficult chapter because of all the historical perspectives. But Lord, what we can count on is that your promises were kept by you to Daniel, and therefore we can count on the promises you've made to us, and that you are a God that keeps his word, and we're safe in you. We're not appointed to wrath. So, Lord, Maranatha, come get us quick. In Jesus' precious name, amen.
On Sunday, I went to the Jewish